Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, writers Nancy Johnson and Catherine Ada West discuss Johnson's hit debut novel, The Kindest Lie. This conversation originally took place February 8th, 2022, and was recorded live at the American Writers Museum. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
Good evening. Welcome, everyone. My name's Allison Sansoni. I'm the program director here at the AWM. We're here tonight to talk about The Kindest Lie, named a most anticipated book by O Magazine, Shondaland, Chicago Tribune, Elle, and many more now out in paperback. A story of family, motherhood, and America itself, it was described by reviewers as the kind of novel you feel in your bones, and nuanced, spellbinding, and necessary. Its author, Nancy Johnson, worked for more than a decade as an Emmy-nominated, award-winning television journalist at CBS and ABC affiliates and markets nationwide. The Kindest Lie was a New York Times editor's choice pick. It has been reviewed by the Times, the Washington Post, Los Angeles Times, and was featured on Entertainment Weekly's Must List. Nancy leads brand communications for a healthcare nonprofit and lives in the South Loop, where she is hard at work writing her second novel, People of Means. She's appearing tonight with Catherine Adel West, who was born and raised in Chicago, where she currently resides. She graduated with both her bachelor's and her master's of science in journalism from the University of Illinois Urbana. Her work is published in Black Fox Literary Magazine, 5-to-1, Better Than Starbucks, 805 Lit and Art, The Helix Magazine, Lunch Ticket, and Gay Magazine. Catherine's short story, Orion's Star, is featured in the body positive anthology, Everybody Shines. Her debut, Saving Ruby King, came out in 2020. Her sophomore novel, Becoming Sarah King, is slated for release in 2022. In between writing and traveling, Catherine works as an editor. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
It's wonderful to be here.
I'm so happy to be here with you, Nancy.
I know this is going to be fun.
It's going to be fun. Yeah.
Great. We had so much fun just leading up to it, like the last hour or so.
I know. Yeah. It's great. We have a thing. It's a thing.
We have a thing.
It's a thing. It's a beautiful thing. So, Nancy, so many things I want to talk to you about. So many things. First of all, being we all know The Kindest Lie is phenom. Oh, that's short for phenomenal. One of the things that I remember thinking about a lot when I was reading the book was just like the idea and the theme of parental abandonment. Mm-hmm. Where did you get that from? Or why did you make that kind of a central theme for The Kindest Lie?
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I was really just interested in talking about family and the Black family, the white family, what it means to return home. Generational trauma was very important to me. Some of the legacy, what do we pass down from generation to generation, from grandmother to mother to daughter, that was really important for me. And it was really a way to just get at some of the racial strife and some of the class divisions and doing it through parental abandonment. And you see that in several of the relationships. The main character, Ruth Tuttle, she has been abandoned by her own mother. And then, a big part of the story is how she abandoned her own child. But then there are reasons why she did it, And a lot of the book, it's about making decisions, keeping secrets, telling lies, but doing it for the best of reasons, or what you think are the best reasons, not only sometimes to protect yourself, but also to protect the people you love.
Absolutely. And then we have to get in with Midnight and his abandonment issues. But speaking of Midnight, where did you come up with that nickname? It's a derisive nickname that's given to him. That's a cool nickname. Just how'd you come up with that? Real quick, just let me know.
Okay. Well, first of all, just who Midnight is. So Ruth has this baby, when she's a teenager. She leaves him behind in this dying Indiana factory town where she grew up. Then she goes back to her hometown to search for her son. And that's where she meets and forms this unlikely friendship and connection with Midnight, who's a poor young white boy, 11 years old, searching for a sense of family and connection, just like she is. And, I just kept thinking, what is a name that a kid like this is a white boy, but he hangs around Black kids a lot, and he's not sure whether you know, they're really accepting him for who he is, or if they're kind of making fun of him on the sly. And so they're like, you know, when it gets dark at night, all of our skin is, you know, dark, it's like midnight. And so it's a nickname that sticks, but it's kind of a cool nickname, you know?
Cool nickname.
Yeah, regardless of intention.
Yeah, I legit just want to go by Midnight personally. I just got Catherine Adele West. I don't have Midnight, but that's okay. Uh-huh. I'll talk to my mom about it. Speaking of which, Gaston, Indiana. Ganton. We all know
Ganton.
Ganton, excuse me. I apologize. Right. Ganton, Indiana.
I say it like it's real.
Yeah. I mean, it is to me.
Right.
But we all know it's a fictional place. Can you just give me a little bit in terms of like, where did you get the inspiration?
Yeah.
For Ganton? I legit, like, I'm not playing. When I first read this, I was like, oh, let me look that up. And it's just like, there's no Ganton, Indiana. I felt a little foolish. So if you
not at all. There are plenty of people who Googled it, thought it was a real town. But I really based it upon towns that I had spent time in. Like Gary, Indiana, I have family there. So that was, you know, one town. Also Kenosha, Wisconsin. I worked there as a news reporter many years ago when I first started my career at an independent TV station. And I remember what happened with that town when it left, when the industry left, the Chrysler plant left that town. And so, and also Anderson, Indiana, I have family there as well. So I was also basing it on that town where the Delco Remy GM plant had been. And then when it left town, you know, there's just something about a town when the industry leaves and it's just desolate. And what does that do to a community and to people? And so that's what I was creating with Ganton. But it wasn't exactly like any of these towns, because it's like Gary, for example, Indiana is predominantly Black.
Yeah.
But Ganton is racially mixed, and that worked for my story. Mm-hmm. And it's a lot about, you know, which side of kind of the tracks you live on.
Yeah.
And what does that mean for you? And so, yeah, I tried to make it as real as possible, but I love the fact that people think it's a real town, because I tried to make it so.
You did that good of a job.
Thank you.
It was
thank
a good
you.
Job. I mean, honestly, you can even compare really again to Chicago. I mean, like, let's be real. Chicago is pretty segregated. So we have our like different sides of the tracks. You know, we have the South and West sides. That's where we reside. We have Summerk and Chinatown. We have, you know what I mean? The Pilsen neighborhood. Like it's Ganton is it's a very small town, but with very universal themes.
Yes.
You know
what I was looking for. And then I set the book in 2008 at the time of the Great Recession. And so I was interested in what happens in a, you know, in a town where you lose industry and, you know, and things are really tough for people. And I think some of these small towns in the Midwest, the industrial Midwest, got hit harder than others. And then that just, I think, exacerbates the racial tension.
Yeah, absolutely. Just want to piggyback off of that. I have so many questions. Okay. Just want to piggyback off of that. We're speaking about 2008, and yes, it's the Great Recession, but we're also talking about Barack Hussein Obama.
Okay,
Michelle,
we got people, like, doing this in the audience.
I know. Michelle flipped my hair back.
Okay.
Obama.
Yes.
It was also.
Hopefully she's watching. She and Barack. I know.
Michelle, we got books out, movies, if you want to help us.
Right. And they
if
do
you
have a
wanna,
production company.
You, so. Y'all got a production company, Netflix. Okay. Speaking of which, we had. There was a great time of great financial stress, but it was also a time of great hope. You know what I mean? Like we all remember a lot of us remember where we were
exactly
when President, you know, Barack Obama, you know, was elected. You know what I mean? So I just want to know, how were you able to balance this theme of hope and resilience along with kind of like a feeling of despair and desolation? And how were you able to, you know, like, how did you kind of figure out in your mind that right balance, that chef's kiss?
Yeah, that's exactly what I wanted to achieve. That's what inspired me to write the book, was the election of Obama. And it was a time, like you said, of great hope, particularly, I think for everybody, really, no matter what your political persuasion was, people felt that we had achieved something by electing our first Black president. But also for the Black community, it was, we were like,
listen,
you know?
Listen.
We really were.
We was on the bus talking about Obama's president. And we were freaking out. We was happy.
We were. I remember talking to my best friend, who's Black, and she was talking about her brother. And when he got elected, she said her brother was like, I ain't going into work tomorrow. We got a Black president. Okay, so taking it a little far, but you know, that was, and then I had that in the book with the character Xavier, Ruth's husband, you know, where he was talking about the, you know, the stereotypically Black foods he was going to take into work the next day because we had a Black president and all that. And so, yeah, so it was a sense of hope. But then even though I was inspired by that, I also remember Facebook was kind of just getting started. And there was all this vitriol that I saw playing out on my social media feed. Particularly between Black and white America.
He's not my president.
Right, he's not my president. And then you saw through the campaign of how both Michelle and Barack were just vilified by so many folks.
She showed her arms. Yeah. That's all she did. She just wanted to show her arms.
The terrorist fist bump. Remember?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And then when Michelle sat up there and said, I'm proud of my country. And then she said, well, you've never been proud of your country before? After 400 years of oppression.
Right, okay. So it just magnified the fact that even though we've got a Black president, and symbolically in many ways it was progress, we still had such a long way to go as a country. And so that was something that I wanted to explore with my characters. And so that's why you've got Ruth, who's very successful. You know, she and her husband got great jobs, you know, beautiful home in Bronzeville. But yet she comes from meager beginnings, more humble beginnings. And when she goes back there, you know, she's kind of walking in two worlds. And so that's that sense of hope and then desolation. But even within the socioeconomic sphere that Ruth exists in, which is, you know, pretty high up there, upper middle class, she and her husband are on the L train and there's a white cop hassling this young Black boy. And they're both sitting there rigid with fear because they know what could happen. And then she goes on her job and she's not getting the promotions that she deserves, you know? And so that's racial. So you can be Black and there can be this sense of hope and you can have a Black president and still be struggling, as we know much of Black America is.
I would high five you right now, but COVID. Okay. So I just wanted to pivot just a little bit.
Yeah.
I just want to talk a little bit about your publishing journey, if you don't mind. Okay. Great, yeah, because I want to too. If you could just give me a little general background about your publishing journey, how you got your literary agent, how you got your book deal, and then I have another question.
Just that little story.
Just
how all that happened.
What I need you to do is do it in 280 characters. Make it like Twitter.
Like a Twitter pitch.
I'm kidding. No, but just try to give us maybe the Cliff Notes version.
Yeah. So I worked most of my career early as a journalist. So I always had that writing background, moved out of journalism into corporate communications. So I was writing there. So I've always been writing, but I was really writing the stories of other people who were making news or telling people's brand stories, but I was never telling the stories of my own imagination. And that's what I really wanted to do. In many ways, I wanted to have a voice and I knew that I could do it through fiction. But I didn't have any background in that. So I started going to writing conferences and just building up my skills, building, you know, the craft knowledge in how to write a novel. Because so many people think, oh, it looks so easy. It's not easy. You know, I had to really study how to do this. And I'm still studying it. I'm still reading books all the time to, you know, study like, okay, how did they structure that scene? How was that put together? Where did they build the suspense? So anyway, I went to workshops to do all that. I started querying literary agents. Because in traditional publishing, you need an agent to be able to get a book deal with one of the big four publishing houses out there. And so I started querying agents, but I queried too soon. Quite often, I don't know if you went through this, but you don't always know when your book is ready.
Yeah. I thought
my book was ready.
I couldn't have told me.
I had one person critique it, you know, a wonderful person critique it, Caroline Levitt, the author. She was the one who gave me a manuscript critique. She's wonderful. She's like a literary fairy godmother to me and gave me a great critique. I rewrote based on that. Then I started, I was like, oh, I'm good. I started sending those puppies out. Rejections started flooding in. And so many rejections. One of them was from Danielle Bukowski of Sterling Lord Literistic. She rejected. And once I got her rejection, she also gave some feedback and I sent her a thank you note. you know, thank you so much for, you know, reviewing my manuscript. And I told her I plan to revise. And so then she wrote me back, if you plan to revise, then send it to me again. And so what I did then was I engaged five, what we call beta readers. So these were other writers who looked over the manuscript, gave me feedback. And then I also went to workshops, 10 House Summer Novel Workshop, studied with Tayari Jones, the author of An American Marriage, Kimbilio Fiction, which is for Black writers, went to that conference, workshopped it. And so then after all of that, I sent Danielle my manuscript again. And not just Danielle, I sent it to other agents as well. And lo and behold, Danielle offered representation along with another agent. So I had two choices for literary agents. So that was like, phew. But I knew there was, that was just one hurdle to cross. I still had to try to get the book deal. And it's the job of the agent to submit your work to editors at publishing houses. And she sent the manuscript out to various editors, I think maybe 25 editors that she sent to. She had a list that she sent to. And
how long did it take? How long did it take?
So to get an agent, it took me like 2 years of querying. It took me 2.5 weeks to get the book deal. I'm like,
yes!
Virtual high five, hey!
Girl!
Yeah, 2.5 weeks. And so I had two offers and went with William Morrow, HarperCollins, and very happy there.
We're HarperCollins girls.
We are.
We're HarperCollins girls.
Yes, so we are publishing sisters.
We are. You are definitely publishing sisters, and yes. You don't know how. At least you workshopped. I just decided I'm going to write a novel and just did it from scratch. Did I go to a workshop? Nope.
We'll see. Kudos to you. I bow down to you. You were able to
make
it happen.
But it could happen a little bit sooner if I'd have actually been like, let me work on my craft with people who actually know something.
How long did it take you from when you started clearing agents?
You're going to hurt me.
Okay.
6 months. Oh, I got an agent at 6 months.
6 months.
And yeah. Then
it took me 2 years. So you just never know.
Yeah, exactly. And then 6 weeks. And then I got the offer on Saving Ruby King from Park Row HarperCollins.
See?
Man, listen.
You just never know.
Black girl magic.
Black girl magic.
Speaking of black girl magic, what are some of the hurdles that you feel that you had to overcome in the publishing industry being a black female?
Being a black female. Yeah. I talk about this a lot on panels, you know, just diversity in publishing. Mm-hmm. You know, people look at the two of us, that we are black authors out here, but there are not a lot. There are not many of us, you know, and people say, oh, we're advancing. Just like with Obama being president, you're pointing to one man. People point to you and me. You know, we can, you know, there's like a handful of us out here who, you know, are published in adult fiction.
Yeah.
Who are black, certainly not enough of us.
No.
But even more so than that, the gatekeepers that we were talking about, there are not enough of us in publishing. We need more black literary agents who are making the decisions on, you know, who to take on, which authors to represent, which careers to represent. We need more black folks in publishing, you know, editors who sales reps, publicity, marketing, every aspect of publishing. We need more of us there. And people don't understand how important this representation is. You think about representation of black folks in media, first of all, there's not a lot, but what is there a lot of times is negative, you know? And so we want to be able to control how we are seen, how we are portrayed, how we are represented. And and so that was a hurdle I knew going in. So as I was looking for agents, there were not a lot of black agents out there. And certainly not representing the kind of work that, you know, I was doing. And so I made sure, like in choosing Danielle, my agent, that I chose an agent who represented authors of color. So she has, so like Brian Washington, who wrote Memorial and Lot, is one of her clients. You know, she just signed somebody this week, Timba, and I'm forgetting her last name right now. It was just announced in Publishers Marketplace, but a black queer woman author, you know, and just got a, you know, great deal also with HarperCollins, I believe, with one of the imprints. So that was important to me in terms of working with my editor. My editor is a white woman, and I remember getting my first editorial letter from her, and which is common. You know, you get your editorial letter with the things that you need to revise. So even though I'd done all this revision, there's still a lot more work to do to bring a book to fruition. And my first editorial letter was 6 pages, single-spaced. Then the next one, 4 pages, single-spaced. Then 2 pages, single-spaced. So at least it was going in the right direction. But in that first letter, she had a lot of things for me to work on.
Yeah.
You know, suspense, character development, plot, that kind of thing. But she also had some cultural things, to answer your question,
yeah,
in there. Like, there was one point where my editor commented on something in my early pages where Ruth, my main character, is getting ready for the Obama night watch party, election party, and she had just moved into a new house, and I had her untwisting her hair. She had natural hair. She's untwisting her hair, and I said she's breathing in avocado and coconut and promise. Mm-hmm. And my editor said, well, she's in a new house. Why not have her be smelling fresh paint? And I was like, no, 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 because for me, those scents had something to do with, you know, blackness,
black hair,
and this sense of promise of what's to come. And I was like, no, it's not, she's not smelling paint. And, but I was nervous about that, because when you spend all this time, for, you know, trying to get into the business,
you don't want to step on toes and sit up there and just be like, I don't want to
say nothing.
You don't want to be that dreaded D word. Difficult.
That's so true.
You don't want to be difficult, because if you get that type of reputation, you know, that next book deal might not come. So sometimes you feel like, man, I might got to lay down and take it. But right. You learn pretty quickly which hill you getting ready to die on, and which hill you just going to be like, you know,
like,
what?
For me,
I had an edit where they were like, I used the word sadity. I was just like, the copy editor, God bless her, she was a great copy editor. It was just like, can you use something else? I don't know what that means. And I'm like, Google it. It's a ditty. Figure it out. Use context clues. That's what I did. You know what I mean? Just, you know, that's what we have to do sometimes.
That's so exactly you, right.
Exactly.
So then I was nervous about bringing this up.
You don't want to be different. Yeah.
Right. And so I decided, going into that first call, because she gave me emailed me those editorial notes, mm-hmm. but gave me some time to, you know, sit on the notes for a while. Then we had our call to discuss. And so I kind of had my plan. I was like, I got to address the black stuff first, you know, get that out of the way before I can even think about plot and character development and all that. And so I brought that up, and I told her just what I told all of you. I explained why I used the fact that she was breathing in avocado and coconut and promise.
One of my favorite scenes, by the way.
Oh, really? Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, that was one of those I workshopped so many times. You
girl,
know how it is, yeah, that first chapter. But so then my editor was like, oh, okay. And she got it. And it wasn't a big deal. It wasn't everything that I had built up in my mind that I would have to really sell to her and convince her. She got it. And then I would say later on, when we were in copy edits, which is another phase of the editing mm-hmm. process, mm-hmm. The copy editor was different from my main editor, but my copy editor noted a scene where Ruth is talking to Xavier, her husband, but at the time they were just getting to know each other. And so she was basically telling Xavier, hey, clear the field of any other, you know, women, I was about to say, well, chicks, girls, women, whatever, that you're messing around with, you know? And so, and he was like, oh, I'm not dating anyone else. And she said, Don't be trying to act brand new. And so I had that in there. Don't be acting brand new.
Right.
And the copy editor said, why don't we change brand new to acting innocent?
No.
And so
sorry.
And so before I could even respond, my editor, my white editor, jumped in and said, nope, that stays. It's clear from the context.
Yeah.
And so I was like, yes, you know.
Yeah.
And so it was just an education process.
Yeah.
Trust building. And now we're cool and she gets it. And yeah, she just didn't know, and now she knows. And she's
and
great
knowing
to work
is half
with.
The battle, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah.
Mm. Okay, so just having a good time here.
I know.
So this is one question I have for you, and I thought about texting to you, and I was reading it. But like, no, it's, I promise you, it ain't like that. Just why do you think it was so much easier for Ruth to relate to Midnight than to relate to Corey, her son, the son she gave up for adoption?
Yeah, yeah. And that's interesting, because Ruth going back, that's the one thing that if readers have certain things that they're like, why did she do that? They're like, why is she going back?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, interrupting the life of this child. And so, but I think there was so much guilt there, you know, for Ruth, with abandoning her child. I think that's what made it difficult to connect. And also because, you know, he has a family, you know, he's got parents. And so that makes it difficult to get close to this child. But and Corey is, you know, Black. But Midnight is this child that she just really stumbles upon. Their families know each other, and that's how she and Midnight connect. But basically, they're like mirror images of each other. They're both science geeks, both of them searching for a sense of family. Ruth's mother is not in her life. Midnight has lost his mother. So they're both searching for something. And I think that's why they were able to connect. And people often ask me, and I don't know if you were going to, but about writing a character like Midnight.
Yeah, I was getting ready. I was going to be my next question. Like, because Midnight is just like, how were you able to write an 11-year-old white boy, right? Yeah. So, I mean, you know, you're a beautiful Black woman, but like to be able to to get into, you know, that mindset and do so realistically and not in some kind of stereotypical type of fashion to bring a real empathy and a real genuine feel to Midnight. Like, I was literally like, what headspace did you have to get in? Did you listen to a particular brand of music? Did you meditate before? like, how did you pull that off?
Oh, thank you. Thank you. And that's the highest compliment when people say that they love Midnight. So many people have said Midnight was their favorite
Midnight
character.
Was my favorite character.
Oh, you're
yeah, Midnight was, yeah, girl, yeah.
So many
yeah.
people are like, I'm thinking about Midnight still. And I'm like, okay.
One person I wanted to punch out was Xavier, but.
Oh, okay. A lot of people told
Midnight.
Me that too. Somebody wanted to punch Ruth too. So people want to punch all the a lot of characters. It just depends. People argue in book clubs over which character they want to punch. But yeah, so Midnight, what I usually tell people is that, you know, I've never been white. So, but, you know, I'm fluent in whiteness by being Black in America. You know, so I'm surrounded by white people and whiteness at all times. And so it's very different for me writing a white character than somebody who's white and trying to write a Black character. That's a very different thing, just so people know that it's not the same. But in terms of understanding him as a boy, an 11-year-old boy, I think that's where the real connection happened, not necessarily the racial piece, but the connection of this boy and it really individualizing, you know, who he is as a child. And that's based on my own experience. I was bullied a lot as a kid. I wrote about it in an essay in the Oprah magazine in 2015 about losing my voice figuratively because I was bullied. And so I know what it feels like to stand on the outside of things, looking in. And that's what I tried to bring to Midnight, was bring that sense of being an outsider and being just desperate to be liked, desperate to please, wanting to fit in, wanting to belong. And so I understood that on a very intimate level. And that's what I channeled in creating Midnight.
Girl, you channeled everything. Girl, I'm gonna give you a hug after this one.
Well,
I wanna pivot a little bit. Just some like writing things. What is your pet peeve as a writer?
Like in other people's writing?
No.
I'm like,
we'd be here all night.
Like in other people's writing?
No.
So what do you mean?
When I say, what is your pet peeve when it comes to writing? Put it like this. Let me be more specific. It must be so much fun to write a book. It's just so easy. You know, like
so the things I hear from other
so
people.
So the things that you hear from other people in terms of like, yeah. What is your pet? Like, what is the one thing where like, if you could slap someone and it's okay, what is like the one thing that just irks you as soon as it comes out of somebody's mouth?
Oh, there's so many. I mean, can you write my book for me? You know, my life story. I'm like, really? No, I can't. you know, it looks so easy. I think I'm going to write a book next month. You know, those kinds of things that come out of people's mouths, you know.
We got a couple of writers in the audience. So that's why they laughing.
People are laughing.
That's why they laughing. Like, oh, you're going to write a book next one, huh? Yeah, really? It took me 5 years for the first one. Good luck.
Good luck with that.
I literally had.
What do you really do? Okay.
Okay, you could have slapped him and I'd have straight just been like, I don't know. He fell into her hand. Like, that's right? Basically what happened.
What had happened? Yeah.
I recently was at a family event. My great uncle had just passed.
My condolences.
Thank you. And as I was leaving, my cousin, who's writing a book, literally grabbed my arm. I kid you not. And was like, Kathy, publish my book.
Oh, wow.
I was like, I don't.
Really?
You know, like when somebody says something, you like trying to process it.
Right.
But like, you can't process it.
Yeah.
I was like, that's not even what I do. I'm not a publisher. Am I Oprah? Does she think I'm Oprah? I'm not Oprah. I don't know. I'm not HarperCollins. I have a book. I don't.
Okay.
Yeah. She literally just grabbed me. She's like, publish my book.
Publish my book. Or introduce me to people who are not even, who haven't written a word, you know.
Right.
Introduce me to your people.
Your agent.
Whoever.
Right.
They don't even know who. It's just, yeah.
Nope. Just grab my arm, said, publish my book.
Wow.
Girl, listen. We thank the Lord.
Because
I haven't
had that one yet.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Just write their book for them.
It's
easy too.
Yeah. Let me just write your book. It's cool. Right. Like, you go ahead and get all the accolades and the glory. Have fun.
I know.
Okay. What are some of your literary influences?
Oh, girl. There's so many people. I mean, there's so many people writing today whom I love. Like, just probably too many to even name. Like, we've talked about T.R. Jones, Britt Bennett, Jacqueline Woodson, Jesmyn Ward, Mary Beth Keane, who else? Dennis Lehane, for me, S.A. Cosby. That's like that was my favorite, even though I wrote a book last year. My favorite book, I think it was last year when it came out, was S.A. Cosby's book, Razor Blade Tears. I love that book. Yeah. Have you read that?
S.A. Crosby. No. Not
he
yet.
Is like,
I'm going to, please don't get me wrong. Like, he, right now. Yeah.
I wrote to him. So I'm like fan. So here I am with a book out, right? And I'm fangirling over him. So I sent him a note on Instagram and I said, I don't want anything from you, because you know how that is too.
Yeah.
What do you want?
You just be like,
I don't need you to introduce me to anybody or blurb my book. I said, I don't want anything, but I just want you to know how much I love that book. And he said, he replied just to thank me, but I was really into that book. Great character development. His two characters, Ike and Buddy Lee, will stay with me forever. And that's how I know it's a book I love. If there are characters that will really live with me for a long time. So those are literary influences, like current, but obviously Toni Morrison, the mother of the
canon.
Canon, the mother of literature for us. So The Bluest Eye, which was her debut novel, is really my favorite of hers, because basically her books were hard for me to get into when I read them in college. They were dense for me and I was unsophisticated as a reader. So I was like, oh, I don't like this. This is hard. You know, that was me in African-American literature class at Northwestern. But anyway, The Bluest Eye is very accessible. I really love that book. And I learned something in writing my own book from The Bluest Eye, because in The Bluest Eye, she starts off telling you that Picola Breedlove was molested, you know, by her father and had a baby by him. And, you know, so you learn that like the first, I think it's the first page, you know, so I'm not giving anything away. She says, that's what happened. And she said, the rest of this book is going to be telling you how this came to be. And I was like, wow. So you can really tell a story by giving something away in the beginning. You don't always have to hold something back. And I learned that. And so in my book, I start off letting you know that Ruth Tuttle, you know, had a baby at 17 and pulled away from her little shotgun house, you know, without her baby. And so you learn that right there in the first paragraph. I tell you that. And then the rest of the book is about the aftermath of that. And so that's why Toni Morrison, one reason she's an influence for me, but also not just the writing, obviously the language, the storytelling, she's the master of it, but her confidence as a Black author, you know?
Yes.
Just that swagger. And just that confidence that she has, that's something I want to embody and carry with me.
Well, I mean, you have the kindest lie. Might as well get started.
Okay.
I mean, I'm just saying.
There you go.
I say walk into it, baby.
We both should. You have Saving Ruby King. Oh, and the Two Lives of Sarah.
Yes, I do. But we're here to talk about you. We're here to talk about you, and we're both walking that confidence. We're here to focus on you. So here it is. The question that I was going to ask you, I told you 2 weeks ago, already know what's up.
Yeah, I was like, what you going to ask me? And she didn't want to tell me, because, I know, I understand.
Have I ambushed you, baby?
You have not, but this was the only one that I think.
This is the one I gave you, I gave you heads up on. So, Michelle and Barack, here I please, okay? they going to make my book into a TV show. They're making your book into a movie. They say, Nancy Johnson, who do you want to be in Kindest Lie, the movie?
And I don't have this all figured out. I really don't. But a few people, so for Ruth, and I don't watch enough TV and movies. I'm like, I think it was Shannon who was saying in the audience here, was saying that she doesn't watch a lot either, and I don't either. But I would say, I think her name is Letitia Wright. From
she's
in Black
Shuri.
Panther.
Shuri from Black
Panther, because she was a scientist and kind of had that kind of role, I could see her as Ruth. And then I'm trying to think of who else. The only other person I thought of was for Eli, her brother, who's one of my favorite characters to create, was Eli. I'm thinking that he's now 27 years old. By the time a movie would come out, he'd be about the age of her older brother. Her brother's like 4 years older than she is. Kofi Siriboy, am I saying it right? So, who plays like Ralph Angel, if you watch Queen Sugar.
Mm-hmm.
And he's in a lot of things.
Girl, this don't.
But yeah, okay, you need a moment.
Actually, I would have put him as Xavier, truth be told. I would have made him Xavier.
You would?
I would have.
Okay.
I would have made him anything, including my boyfriend.
I see him as being too hard. Okay. I see him as being too hard for Xavier.
Xavier is a little soft. He's softer, and Kofi got a
girl. Some Timberlands.
We're not going to do this. Just keep find somebody else right now. Find somebody else.
I didn't think of anyone for Xavier. Anyone have any recommendations for any of the characters if you've read the book?
I told you a young Jason Tremblay to me would be perfect for Midnight.
Okay, because I didn't know who that was when you were
talking. The Room. Okay. Oh God, what else is Jacob Tremblay in? Good Boys.
Yeah.
But he's a little too old now. We would need or a younger Haley Joel Osment. But we just gotta find somebody else for Midnight. We'll just do an open casting call for him. But Jacob Tremblay to me would have been perfect for Midnight.
Okay.
Oh, he'd have been perfect.
All right. I think the problem with thinking of characters, not for the children so much, mm-hmm. but the adults, is I'm now older, and so when I think about people, I think about people who are hot in kind of my day or my era, like Denzel. But of course Denzel will be too old to play.
Maybe. I mean, Denzel ain't never too old.
Right. But he can maybe play Pop.
We can just put in some Jess for Men. put in some Jess for Men. It's okay. Like, don't worry about it. Like, Denzel can play. I mean, like, he just finished playing Macbeth. I mean, I walked around looking at Macbeth and I just kept saying way-faced loon as an insult, like, for the rest of the week. Like, Denzel Washington, he ain't do anything.
Yeah, so that's all I got. I don't have anybody else.
Girl.
Yeah.
Well, thank you both so much for this wonderful conversation. Thank you to everyone who has joined us in person and online. The book is The Kindest Lie, and you can purchase that from our bookselling partner, Seminary Co-op, at semcoop.com. Thank you both so much.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank
you for the audience here in person, and thank you to everyone online watching. We really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. I had such a blast with you, Nancy, and I had a blast with all of you lovely folks here and online.
Yeah, and The Two Lives of Sarah, coming from Park Row Books,
September 2022, guys. It's going to be lit.
And for now, becoming...
Saving Ruby King, that came out June 2020, also available on paperback at all your local bookstores.
Yes. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, writer-director Rebecca Hall discusses her recent Netflix film, Passing, with Northwestern University professor Dr. Ivy Wilson. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.